In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 412. Today I am sharing with you a talk I gave at my kids' school last week. My kids go to a K through 12 private school, and the 11th graders, I don't have an 11th grader, my oldest is turning 12 next month, but she was in attendance for this special talk. Every year I give a talk in the 11th grade Great Ideas course, which goes through a lot of the important ideas that have been debated over the course of Western civilization, but that includes discussions of the major schools of political thought. So you would go through socialism and the progressives, no doubt, and a whole bunch of different schools of thought. But of course, classical liberalism or libertarianism is one of those. And so every year I come in and I talk about the ideas of classical liberalism. I mention a few of the important thinkers, and I'm the guest lecturer. And I've been doing this, as I said, for several years. And every time I do it, I get people on Facebook saying, well, why didn't you record it so we can hear what you said? So this year I did. Now, here's the thing, though. I had this audio recorder sitting around, and I never really learned how to use it. And then at the last minute, I realized I should use this to record what I'm about to do. But I didn't have time to fiddle with it and really get the hang of it. So the audio is a little hot. So, you know, those of you who are audiophiles in particular will notice that. The audio is a little hot. So, you know, you occasionally get the New York subway announcement effect in the audio, but it's still of good enough quality that I wouldn't just toss it and, you know, not consider using it. In fact, I interviewed somebody last week whose audio was so bad that I was tossing and turning thinking about it, and I actually had to chuck that interview, and he was kind enough to redo it using a different audio input. I ended up buying him a brand new microphone so that we can have crystal clear communication in the future. Anyway, so it's not like that. It's perfectly adequate, but it's not exactly like the sound quality you're getting at this very moment. So I hope you enjoy that. There are some student questions interspersed throughout, and I don't know what the volume on that is going to be like, but the questions don't go on that long. And I thought they were good enough questions that it was not a good idea to exclude them. And I'll just mention the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/412, will contain some of the resources that I mention in the talk. I mention a video that I made. I mention an article that I wrote. Stuff like that will be available over at tomwoods.com/412. Now, before we get going on this episode, because this is a long one, it's a long episode, it's over an hour, I want to tell you what's coming up because we got a couple of juicy ones coming up. Tomorrow we're talking to Peter Klein of the University of Missouri. We're going through a Salon article. I know you guys love when we take an article and we critique it point by point. And this is an article basically saying the rich are a bunch of parasites and we don't need them. And the state can be just as entrepreneurial as the private sector. And we go after that point by point. You're going to enjoy that. That's tomorrow. That'll be episode, for those of you who are not doing them in chronological order, that'll be episode 413, of course. And then episode 414 on Monday, I am talking to Austin Peterson of thelibertarianrepublic.com. So the website is thelibertarianrepublic.com. Austin has become a very controversial figure. He has said many provocative things, I think in some cases designed to get a rise out of some of us. So we are going to hash it out together on Monday, and that is one you are definitely not going to want to miss. So if you haven't subscribed yet on iTunes or Stitcher, now's the time to do it so you don't miss these upcoming episodes. You get them delivered to you for free. The show, of course, is always free, Monday through Friday, so please subscribe over at tomwoods.com. And now here we go with my talk to the Great Ideas class. This is a Great Ideas course, and you have been talking about some great ideas, but you haven't always been talking about people maybe you might agree with, and you might not have thought some of them were such great ideas. But the idea here is that these are topics and people and schools of thought that have been debated and indeed have often been tried in some cases. In the case of Marxism or progressivism, we've actually tried these things and seen what the results are. And one of the schools of thought that you would have to
discuss if you want to have a thorough overview of all the different ways people have thought society should be arranged would be the one that we're looking at today that basically dates back to the, you could say, the 17th century, really matures in the 18th century, and that's liberalism. And right off the bat, I have to clarify the term liberalism, because today liberalism means Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, people like that, Joe Biden. But in the 17th and 18th centuries, it did not mean that at all. It meant something like the opposite of that. So we're going to use this word. I want you to wash out of your brain any previous usage of the word liberalism, because it's only going to confuse you. Pretend that you're encountering this word for the first time. So that's why we refer to it as classical liberalism, to distinguish it from liberalism in 2015. I want to talk about liberalism in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s. Well, 1800s, and then 1900s is when the word starts to change meaning. So liberalism is a major chapter in the intellectual history of Western civilization. Today, we just have a whole new word for it, because we've just given up trying to use liberalism because it's too confusing because the meaning has changed. So it's usually called libertarianism today. And what I'm going to do is go through, according to what the main liberals taught, what their basic ideas were, and then I'm going to kind of draw out what later liberals have added to this structure. Because the early liberals, let's say, I mean, you can trace liberal ideas way, way, way back. I just read a book by Fred Miller who claims to find them in Aristotle. Okay, maybe if you really try, you can find them there. But certainly we would say it comes to maturity in the 17th and 18th century. So we see, for example, there's a group of people during the English Civil War. Did you guys ever study the English Civil War and they execute Charles I? Does this ring a bell with people? Okay, good. There was a group of people during the English Civil War called the Levelers. People think they're communists because they're called Levelers, and they think maybe these people wanted to give everybody an even amount of property. That's not true. They were not commies. There were commies called the Diggers, but we're not talking about them. The Levelers are some of the first libertarians because they were talking about these ideas of, that we're going to get into in a minute, individual rights, individual liberty, the right to property, various other freedoms. So we can say the 1640s, we see it starting to come into fruition. Going down to John Locke in the late 1600s, we have one of the most powerful and important and lasting expositors of liberalism, John Locke, extremely important. Did you read any John Locke in this class? Oh, okay, that's great. I don't even need to dwell on John Locke. That's good. So that's where we're starting. So, although the early liberals probably wouldn't have put it quite this way, this is probably the way modern liberals, libertarians would put it. What they're concerned with is the question of the use of violence in society. And if you ask me, this is what every school of political thought ultimately boils down to. When are you allowed to use violence? Now, the classical liberal or libertarian would say that you are allowed to use violence only in very, very restricted circumstances. So they would say that you may not initiate violence against anybody who has not himself initiated violence. So you can respond to somebody who's attacking you. So they're not pacifists. I mean, there's a handful of them who are pacifists, but the vast majority of them are not. If you're being attacked, a libertarian is not going to say, well, that's just the way the world is. You can defend yourself. But in that case, you're not initiating aggression. You're responding to aggression. What the libertarians are against is the initiation of aggression. So don't take people's things. Don't physically harm people. I mean, just the sort of basic things you were taught when you were 5 years old are pretty much what libertarians are trying to apply across the board. So when people hear that, they think, well, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. We shouldn't use violence against peaceful people. But as we go along, we'll see exactly what that means from a libertarian standpoint. In fact, let me remind myself, let's make sure I hit examples, because if you're not scandalized by libertarians today, then I haven't explained it well. All right, so the next thing really is just the term for what I've just described, the non-aggression principle. The non-aggression principle is a modern libertarian way of expressing this idea, that if you're a libertarian, you agree with the principle that no one should initiate aggression, physical force against anyone who has not done so likewise. So you can use aggression against a criminal, against an invader, but you can't use aggression against any peaceful person. No matter how much you disagree with that person, no matter how harmful you think that person's behavior may be, if that person is not committing aggression, you can't commit aggression against that person. You can argue against that person. You can put up posters saying the person's an idiot. You can write newspaper articles persuading people the person is all wrong. That's as far as it can go. The key text, if you were to try to get a grip on classical liberalism, is one of the tiniest books ever written. And in a way, that's very revealing, that it's one of the tiniest books ever written, because you really don't need that many pages to say, don't hit people and don't take their stuff. And in fact, there is a book that I just interviewed for my podcast last year. Matt Kibbe has a book called Don't Hurt People and Don't Take Their Stuff. And that's his modern take on libertarianism. Okay, so it doesn't even have to be all that long. The Law is one of these little books, you can find it online for free, that so many people say, I read this book by Frédéric Bastiat, who was a great French classical liberal, died unfortunately young. He only lived from 1801 to 1850. But it's one of these little books that there's a million reviews of it on Amazon, and they're all saying, this book changed my life. Now, I used to, when I first got my PhD, I taught for a few years at a community college. And I thought, all right, this is perfect for students at a community college, right? It's they're busy. They most of them have full-time jobs. I'll give them this tiny little book to read. You would have thought I was asking them to read War and Peace. The book is not even, you know, like it disintegrates in your hands. It's so small. And it was that they couldn't understand any of it. I thought, what hope is there? You can't understand this tiny little book, which is about don't punch people in the face for no reason. You know, I'm not getting this. This is not resonating, people are telling me. I know you guys could understand it, okay? So over the summer, if you read one page every 5 weeks, you would finish this book. It'd be no problem. You could zip through it and you'd say, how educated am I that I've now read this book? All right, so where do these ideas come from? How do libertarians or liberals, how do they arrive at the ideas that they have, particularly this idea? Where does this come from? Where does it derive from? And there are different sources. I've listed two, but there are a bunch more that exist, especially today. There's been a lot of development of this, but I'm taking the two basic ones. Have you done utilitarianism?
Not in the moral philosophy yet. That's next year.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm going to do the dumb guy version, yeah. Utilitarian. I mean, it doesn't really matter. But utilitarianism is one of the ways that you reach this idea, and it basically says that the reason that we shouldn't physically aggress against people is that society just doesn't work well when we do that. It doesn't work well if people feel like they can murder at will and they can seize things from people. It doesn't work. So society functions much more smoothly when we respect people's bodily integrity, we respect their private property. Then we get we can have social cooperation, we can have large-scale production. We can't have that if people are hacking each other to bits all the time. So I give as an example one of the greatest economists of the 20th century. In case you don't know, EG means for example. For example, Ludwig von Mises. Mises, in addition to being an economist, was a political philosopher. And he believed in this stuff on utilitarian grounds. Society functions more smoothly when we have these views and we live by them. But there's another competing way of getting to classical liberalism, which is to say, well, all right, well, it's nice that society works well when we're not killing each other, but that's not the main reason we don't do it. I mean, if somebody were about to kill you, you wouldn't say, now, wait a minute, hold on, social cooperation is going to be impaired if you kill me, because then other people might start murdering. It would seem odd that you would make that kind of appeal. You would make a moral appeal. Like, even if it, regardless of what effect it has on society, it has a really bad effect on me when people try to murder me. So the natural rights argument is to makes a moral argument. It's morally wrong regardless of how it helps or doesn't help society, it's morally wrong to interfere with people's liberty, the use of their bodies, the use of their properties. This is morally wrong because people have rights to those things. And it's wrong for you to interfere with their rights. Mises did not believe in the concept of rights. He thought this was a fairy tale. There's no such thing as rights. He did not believe in that. The natural rights people will say, Mises reaches the right conclusions, but for the wrong reasons. So they do believe that we have rights. And in a minute, we'll go into what exactly are the rights that we have, according to liberals. But a right, you can think of a right as like a sphere of action. in which it would be wrong for someone to interfere with you. So if I have a right to read whatever book I want to read, then somebody who is taking my books or burning books is violating that right. So a right then is this scope that I have for unhindered action. Now, of course, we know John Locke is a teacher of natural rights, because he's talking all about this in the Second Treatise on Government. I assume that's what you guys read? Okay. And then Murray Rothbard makes John Locke look like nothing. I mean, Rothbard thinks even John Locke isn't hardcore enough in his support for individual rights. So these are both individual rights, natural rights teachers. So it's morally wrong to interfere with somebody's use of his body or his property. Okay, property rights, and let me also put positive and negative rights. Because this is where we'll go into how do we know exactly what rights we have. Let's look at this very interesting and intriguing statement by John Locke, that every man has a property in his own person. Rothbard's going to run with this one. Now, maybe a better way of saying that is that you own your own body. Now, we've sometimes heard this expression used in debates over abortion. Let's try and get that out of our heads, too, because that'll make it difficult for us to think about this properly. What he means by this, if you have property in something, it means you can use it, and you have a better claim to use it than anybody else. If you have property in a car, that means if somebody's going to borrow your car, they have to ask you first, because you have the best claim to use it of anybody. Well, he's going to say that likewise, your physical body, you have the best claim to decide what happens to your physical body, like where you go and what you do, as compared to anybody else. And even if we want to get really grotesque and morbid about it, if you wanted to donate a kidney to somebody, that would be your decision. Like, people can't just come up to you and start grabbing body parts, because you would have the right to decide that, because it's yours. You used it first, so it belongs to you. In the same way that, again, when we're kids, well, I had it first, means I have some prior claim on it. And so in the same way that if I did something first to some piece of property, I own it. Same thing holds for your own physical body. Rothbard develops this all the way. Rothbard thinks that this is the key insight, and he believes that this insight is what grounds all individual rights. Once we say that you have a property in your own body, he believes that there can't possibly be any grounds for the government to tax you. Can't possibly be any legitimate moral grounds for that. Rothbard goes through in his book, The Ethics of Liberty, he goes through all different other possibilities. He says, all right, one possibility is that everybody owns himself. But let's consider all the other possible options. Maybe we have a world where nobody owns himself. Let's look at what would happen there. Or maybe we have a world in which some people own other people. Or maybe we have a world in which some people own a portion of themselves and a portion of other people. And he goes through all these alternatives, and every single alternative leads to an absurdity. So he indirectly proves that this must be correct. Now, last time I spent a lot of time developing how he does this. I'm not going to do that here. If you're completely crazy, I have a series on this on YouTube, Where Do Rights Come From? And I do develop this. All we want to know now is that this is Rothbard's view. He believes that everybody owns himself 100%. And that means no one can take anything from you, including the government, because the government would just be committing aggression against you. You're a peaceful person, you haven't bothered anybody, and then they come along and say, well, we need 35% of what you just earned, and then when you die, we're going to tax you for dying, and then we're... No, he doesn't accept any of that. Now, how do we know what rights we have? All right, so we know a right is something that you enjoy that no one can take from you. It would be morally wrong for them to do it. But what are my rights? Do I have a right to a Cadillac? Do I have a right to 5 weeks of paid vacation? What do I have a right to? Do I have a right to orange juice? How do I figure out whether I have rights or not? And I'll pause, by the way, after here. I'll pause and see if you have any questions. But let me just finish this discussion here. And this concept of positive and negative rights helps us to understand what rights we have. Now, positive and negative sounds like these must be good rights and these must be bad rights. That is not what they mean. Let's think of it this way. Let's imagine two people on a desert island. Two people on a desert island could both enjoy the right to life at the same time. There'd be no contradiction there. I could live and you could live and we'd both be happy. There are enough coconuts to last us 300 years. We're both happy. But suppose we were both on a desert island and I said, I have a right to a Cadillac. Now, apart from the fact there obviously are no Cadillacs on a desert island, let's think about what that would really mean. If we're talking about natural rights, natural means you have them by nature. You have them because you're a human being. That's why you have them. By virtue of being human, you have them. If they are natural, they have to be things that we all have, or then otherwise they're not natural to us as human beings. So it's natural for us to have reason. At least our species, it's natural for us to have reason. I mean, individual ones of us may not have it because of some damage to our bodies or something, but it's natural to our species to have reason. Well, it would be equally natural to have these rights. So therefore, any right that we can't all exercise at once can't be natural. If only some of us could exercise it, then it's not natural. Now let's think about the right to a Cadillac. Let's suppose it's you and I, and we are not on a desert island, we're in the United States. And you could dig up all the parts you needed for a Cadillac. If you really had to, you could find the manual and figure out how to make one. If their life depended on it, maybe you could do that. And if I said to you, I would like to exercise my right to a Cadillac, please, what would that require of you? You would have to go do it. So you are not enjoying the right to a Cadillac at the same time and in the same way that I'm enjoying it. I'm getting a Cadillac. You're working. That's two totally different ways. So this is not a natural right. Because for me to enjoy that right, you have to do slave labor. So it can't be natural. But for me to live, for me to go on living and you not to kill me, doesn't require you to do anything. It requires you to not do something. Don't kill me. So that's the idea of a right to a Cadillac is a positive right. That I would have an obligation to give you a Cadillac, a positive obligation. That's a positive right. Or I have the obligation to give you medical care. I'm obligated. I have no choice. I have to give it to you. That's a positive right. A negative right would be something like the right to life, the right to property. Because those things really, if you really express them correctly, those are actually negative propositions. The right to life is not the right to a kidney dialysis machine. On a desert island, there are no kidney dialysis machines. It'd be impossible for you to exercise your right to a kidney dialysis machine there, therefore it can't be a natural right. Your right to life simply means that no one has the right to murder you. You have the right not to be killed. It's a negative right. You have a right not to be killed. You don't have the right to demand anything positive of anyone else. You can ask them. They might be nice and give you things, but you don't have a right to that. Likewise, the right to property doesn't mean that people have to give you stuff. Hey, I want to exercise my right to property, so I'll take, all those antiques you have. No, your right to property really means the right not to be stolen from. So it really, these are negative propositions. And according to the classical liberals, these are the rights you have. Because we can all exercise these rights in the same way and at the same time. All of us not being stolen from at the same time is conceivable. But all of us demanding our right to a Cadillac at the same time? How could that happen? Some people would have to do all the work and we'd have to sit here, and we'd sit here. So that could not be exercised at the same time in the same way for everybody. So therefore, no such thing. Only these. Okay? In fact, I'll stop there and ask. I can't tell because I think and talk about this stuff constantly, 24 hours a day. Does this make sense? Am I belaboring this? Are you following along? All right. Anything you want clarified or questioned? Anything like that? Yeah, go ahead.
Would this be considered natural law or the laws that governments have to give, have to supply?
Okay. So for example, I think you're onto a good question here. When you say this, though, tell me what you mean by this.
This idea of the negative rights, you can't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. They would think of this in terms of a natural law idea, because they would say that almost any government imaginable is going to try to enforce some kind of positive right. They're going to say that everybody has a positive obligation to contribute towards some cause. But to the extent that they demand that, that violates liberal principles. Now, and again, the liberal does not say, or the libertarian does not say, it's morally wrong for you to give things to people. They would say that it's up to you to do it. Think of it today. You're just an average person. You're not an employee of the government, and you have a really, really good charity, really important charity. You can ask people to donate to your charity. You can make videos. You can have a Kickstarter campaign. But you can't just go up and take people's stuff and say, but I promise you this is really, really important. I mean, this is the most important thing in my whole life. We would know that you can't do that. But the libertarian would say, but then how come, and this is really what Bastiat is saying, there's got to be one moral law that binds everybody. If I can't do that, how come a group of people, you know, with the police behind them, can do that? If it's wrong for me to do it, how does it magically become right just because these magical people that people checked off a box for in a voting booth somewhere, how do they have a right that I don't have? Either that right exists or it does not exist. Either there are moral standards or there are not moral standards. So, yeah, that would be the answer to that. Yeah, do you want to follow up?
On what you just said. So, Bastiat, he would be against government seizing land for certain, development.
Oh, definitely. Eminent domain. Yes, I would be virtually certain, even though practically all governments have claimed a right of eminent domain. I mean, it basically goes back to days when the presumption was that the king was the implicit owner of everything and he was just kindly letting you use it. Well, if that's the case, then you can see how he could argue that at any moment he could reclaim his what's rightfully his. Of course, in a democratic society, we don't believe in things like this. We just think that if judges say your property should be taken, then it can be taken. But yeah, he would say that, no, you have to negotiate. In the same way that I personally couldn't go up to you and say, I have a better use for your property than what you're putting it to. Even though this property means everything in the world to you and you couldn't even put a money amount on it, I have something that I think would really benefit more people. We'd say, well, that's really nice and everything, but go buy property somewhere else and do it. Yes?
But I mean, didn't the person, I guess, sort of agree to a social contract by being in the country, I guess, and so they kind of gave up their right to property if it's for the common good?
Okay, yeah, so that is the... Wow, so this is 11th grade? Okay, let me just tell you something. There aren't 11th graders who would make that objection. So that's really good. The social contract objection. Now, I actually have a YouTube on this called When Did I Sign This Social Contract? There's something very unusual about the social contract because it's unlike any other contract we ever sign. Because in this one, you don't actually sign anything. You're just suddenly told, well, you've agreed to these rules because you're standing here. Now, I don't know exactly how Locke would handle that because he does hold to something like a social contract agreement in part of his thinking. But it would basically boil down to, think about in our society, everything you do that's important. You buy a car, you write out, there are contracts going up and down this thing. You take out a mortgage, you got a credit rating agency involved, you got 12 signatures, you got everything signed in triplicate just for buying a house. But yet the social contract argument says, okay, we're going to say that we can take what we think we need to take from you in perpetuity. We can tell you to go fight in a war that you may be morally opposed to. We can do all these things. We can educate your kids in ways that you object to. And if you want to escape from that, you have to pay double. We can make all these demands from you, but we're just going to assume you go along with it and not ask you to sign anything. That's highly unusual. And moreover, it seems weird to say that the person being aggressed against is the one who has to leave. For me to show, in other words, how could the social contract be meaningful if there's no way for me to show I don't really hold it? I have to leave the country? Well, what if the mafia took over my town and started giving me a bunch of demands and then said that I implicitly signed a social contract because I haven't left the town? Well, why don't they leave? They're the ones who are making demands. Why would I be the one who has to leave? So in other words, by merely standing somewhere, when I mean, not only that, let's imagine I'm somebody who does not have the financial means to leave. I couldn't possibly leave. This is where I happen to be. For them to say that I have agreed to whatever rules may ever be imposed on me because I happen to be physically located somewhere, I think is demanding too much. But anyway, as I said, I made a video on this that gives more, you know,
you
less cheeky.
In the reading from Monday, from last.
Oh, did he talk about that in that reading?
Well,
I haven't read that in a while.
He implicitly does. Remember how what he would say to that in that first section of the reading?
Good. I don't remember it either. So.
Wasn't he the one that talked about what the state is not?
Right.
So maybe he said the state is not.
State not in that first section. Us. We.
Yeah, oh, that's okay.
Right? And all the absurdities that would seem to follow if we are the government, then anything the government does to us is voluntary. Remember, that's why he says, so the Jews they were murdered, they committed suicide. Right? If we are the government. Right?
Right.
That was one of his arguments.
Yeah.
I wonder if Rothbard would make a similar, if that's what he would
he
say.
He probably would. I can't remember if and where he deals with the social contract objection.
Yeah, I think there's an implicit critique in that.
Yeah, but and also the social contract assumes that the government basically owns all the property and therefore can impose rules on people. Like, it would be one thing for me to say to you, one of my friends puts it this way, if you come over to my house and I say the rule is that while you're in my house you have to wear this funny hat, and you say, well, I'm sorry, I have too much dignity for this, sir, I'm not going to wear any such hat, I have every right to ask you to leave. But what I can't do is for me to come to your house and demand that you wear the funny hat. Because that's your house, and I don't, that's your property that you acquired. I have nothing to do with it. I don't make any, that's why parents say, as long as you're under my roof, they're implicitly being classical liberals, okay? Maybe you don't like that principle, but they own the house. And so they are the rule makers. So for government to basically say that we can make all these rules and impose them on everybody, basically without their individual consent, is to implicitly say they own everything, which is not certainly not a liberal principle. All right, let's just do this quickly. How do they get property rights? So it's okay. I can see how they say that individuals have the right to do certain things because they own themselves. But how do I come to own a podium or a Sharpie or a car or land or whatever? And to make a long story short, you've got the John Locke answer, which has to do with homesteading. Locke is imagining a world before there are any individual property titles, before we can say Jane owns that plot of land and Sam owns this plot, before any individual owns anything. Locke wants to know, how does an individual come to own something? And he uses the expression, he talks about mixing your labor with something. So you may have read that in the second treatise, and the idea is that if I cultivate some land, or I grow some trees, or even if I just take some fruit that falls off a tree, I've done something. I have mixed my labor with the thing, and the thing becomes mine. It's withdrawn from the state of nature, and it becomes mine. Now, the one objection to this way of thinking was raised by a much later thinker, Robert Nozick, who said, okay, if Locke is going to say that mixing my labor causes me to own the thing I mix it with, then what if I took a can of tomato juice and poured it into the Atlantic Ocean? Do I now own the Atlantic Ocean? I mixed my labor with it. I went to the effort of pouring a can of tomato juice in it. And so what we have to go back to is, what is Locke really, what does he really mean? And this is, when you're in graduate school and you can't think of what to write about, you always write a paper on what such and such thinker really meant. And so here, one thing that has been argued is that what Locke really means is not just mixing your labor, but improving something, making it more productive, making it more valuable for the human race. If I cultivate this land and I grow crops on it, I've made it more valuable. Whereas pouring tomato juice in the Atlantic Ocean does not make it more valuable. This has also been developed further by later thinkers into a first user way of thinking, that the first person to use something is the rightful owner of that thing. Now, this may seem arbitrary. Why shouldn't it be the first person is not morally better than the second or third or fourth person to own something. Well, why should the first person to control something be the owner? And the answer, again, is that when you think about what the alternatives are, they're all unacceptable. So one alternative could be, All right, we won't say that the first person who starts using something is the owner. Let's say the third person. But then, if the imagine we're talking about food here. So I'm the first person to grab, you know, a grapefruit, let's say, and I'm really hungry. But remember that only the owner can decide what's done with something, right? Again, with the car example, only you can decide who drives your car or where it goes. Likewise, only the owner of a grapefruit can decide who eats it. I'm the first person to grab this grapefruit, but if the rule is that the third person is the one who owns it, I'm supposed to sit around and wait for a third person. Maybe I'll be dead by then. So no one can do anything while we're waiting around for the third or the fifth or the seventh or the 18th person. So there seems to be a natural sense that the first person has a claim that nobody else, certainly there's no better claim, there's no reason that the third person should have a better claim than the first one. Secondly, we could say, instead of saying that the first user of something is the owner, we could say the first person to declare that he owns something. Like, what if I just, well, you know, let's say I'm like a 16th century explorer, and I come to a new continent, and I just plant my flag in the ground, and I declare that I own everything that the eye can see. Well, of course, Rothbard does not accept that either. But also, other people will just come along and say, well, we declare that we own it. That doesn't settle, that doesn't promote social harmony. And that's one of the things that the liberals are looking to do. They want social harmony. And if we're going to decide ownership on the basis of shouting, okay, the person who owns this car is the person who shouts the loudest or keeps on shouting or whatever. Well, there's no way we can arrange society in that way. We could say, how about we have no such thing as property? That'd be another way of organizing society. But if there's no such thing as property, then no one's allowed to do anything with anything, because that's what property is. If you own something, you're the one who's allowed to say what happens to it. If no one owns anything, then no one can say what is to be done with anything, and again, we would all starve. So there does seem to be at least a prima facie reason to go with this first user, first homesteader principle. All right, let's take this to the modern day so that we see what the real implications of this are, because this all seems very abstract about rights and whatever. What does this actually mean in practice? Well, certainly it means a laissez-faire economy, which means a free market economy, which means an economy in which people, individuals, are free to buy what they want, sell what they want, and enter into contracts. They can't enter into contracts that involve, putting out a hit on someone to have them murdered because of the old non-aggression principle. Can't do that. That would not be recognized in the courts. But that's the implication of this. So it turns out that a lot of, not all, but a lot of classical liberals were economists, because they did believe in this, and it follows from these principles. When you are in traditional schools, let's say, you come out of those schools with a certain impression of what it's like to live in a laissez-faire free market economy. And the impression you get is, in an economy like that, where there is little to no government involvement, life is terrible, because everybody earns 10 cents a day, and they're working in coal mines, getting their limbs blown off, and all their food is poisoned, and their consumer products are blowing up in their faces because there's no safety regulation and so on. And so you come to this conclusion that nobody in his right mind could possibly support this. I mean, yeah, I like the idea of buying and selling, but, you know, we got to have limits. We got to have, you know, regulation. We got to do this and that. Okay, that's a big topic, and I'll try and deal with that in the misconceptions section. But I want to at least explain how the idea of a laissez-faire market economy, how it works, and why there's been so much attraction to it. Not just that it's created the wealthiest societies in the history of the world, but there's also structural questions. The first one is this. You often hear the phrase, people before profits. Boy, profits are evil. People think, by the way, that the typical grocery store probably earns like a, 45-cent profit on every dollar, when it's like 2 or 3 cents. Like, they barely survive. And you got all these people who are not libertarians demanding, you got to pay this much per hour, you got to do this and this, out of all your fat cat profits. Yeah, their fat cat profits are like this big. Selling peas, you think you're going to make a fortune selling peas? They make this much. That's true of almost everybody. Like, they barely can function. So it's not some endless supply of goodies. But it turns out that profits actually play an important role in society, because think of it this way. There are all kinds of things that could be produced. And people have tried to produce all kinds of crazy things. And some things that they thought would sell well flopped completely. And other things that nobody expected to do well did really well. You guys are too young to remember the pet rock.
We brought that up last
year. Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Hey, ain't no way this thing should have succeeded, right? So sometimes you just can't tell what consumers are going to want until you produce it. But the point is, if we really don't want something, we just don't buy it. And that's bad news for a business. If people aren't buying, they start suffering losses. So they have to scale back. And if they keep suffering losses, they have to close their doors. That's our way of saying, stop producing that thing. You're wasting resources that could be put to better use. You could be making things we actually want out of those raw materials. So instead of throwing the guy into a concentration camp or blowing his head off, we just don't buy the thing, and eventually he gets the hint. Okay? This is how we do this, you know, non-aggression. So that's a way to make sure that bads aren't produced. But to make sure that goods are produced, we buy good things that we like. And let's say there's some product, a widget. Everybody likes this particular widget. They all buy a whole bunch of them, and the widget company is just swimming in profits. Other people who are wondering what to do with their miserable lives say, well, everything else has failed for me, but how about widgets? Because I see this guy is doing really well. So you go into widget production. Now more people produce widgets. The more widgets are produced, the lower the price for each widget. The more of anything, the lower the price. Because when there's competition, they're going to compete with each other on price. And this is going to put downward pressure on profits. I mean, imagine, if you're the only widget producer, you're going to do pretty well profit-wise if people like widgets. But if all of a sudden there are 100 widget producers, we all understand the principle that you may still do okay, but you're not going to do as well as if you were the only one. So as more people get into widget production, this pushes down profits and stabilizes at a point where nobody wants to either leave or enter the production of widgets, because now we've reached a point at which the consuming public has all the widgets they want, to the extent that the creation of more widgets would come at the expense of the creation of something else they'd rather have in addition to the widgets. So profits are what make entrepreneurs figure out what we want, what we don't want, and also how to produce it. There are a million ways you could produce a lot of things. You could use this input or that put or whatever. And they figure out on the basis of prices which is the best way to produce it, the most efficient way to produce it, so that we waste the least. Because if we waste, we're going to have to sell at a higher price. We're going to lose customers. They're constantly thinking about what is the optimal way to arrange all the resources in society. This is not anything that one human mind could possibly do. Arrange all the resources in society and figure out exactly where they all belong and what production process they should be in and how many widgets they should produce and where they should produce the widgets and using what process to produce the widgets. There's no way you could know that even for widgets, much less for the whole economy. But profits direct these things. So that's, and it doesn't involve putting people in concentration camps or murdering or anything. It's just with non-aggression, you get this natural, smoothly functioning system. You get a price system. When you and I buy things, this gives rise to prices. This is where prices come from. And prices eventually, you know, they're always moving, but they're trying to settle somewhere, but they're always sort of on the move in response to supply and demand. And when I mean free prices, I mean prices that are determined without the government being involved. So, as far as I know, the price of Sharpies has nothing whatsoever to do with the government. So this would be an example of a freely reached price. But there have been times when governments have wanted to interfere with prices. They're unhappy with prices. Prices are too high. The price of this thing is too darn high. Let's lower it. So we'll skip price floors. We'll do price ceilings. Governments will sometimes put a ceiling on prices. The price of something is not allowed to go higher than this. And people think, that's great. Boy, that's going to help the poor so much by keeping prices down. Now, everybody wants to help the poor, and everybody wants to keep prices down. But think of what happens here. Do you do economics in the school or not?
Well, it's a sort of an elective course. So Stephen, are you the only one that took economics?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I won't do a supply and demand curve then. Instead. All right. Instead, we'll just put it this way. Think of, let's say, milk. All right. Milk got kind of expensive over the past 10 years. Like, it was suddenly became, like gasoline, became very expensive. So you may say, you know, it's terrible that the poor have to pay so much for milk. So let's lower the price of milk from, maybe it's $3.50 a gallon right now. Let's lower it to 10 cents a gallon by law. 10 cents a gallon by law. Now everybody will have 10-cent milk. There are actually two problems with this and two reasons that this is not going to work. Can you think of the one obvious one?
Well, the company wouldn't be able to produce the milk.
Exactly. Chances are there aren't a whole lot of companies that could survive selling milk at 10 cents. So the supply of milk will go way down. Okay, that one is, I mean, you may not have any milk at all. So yeah, everybody gets it at the same price of zero, but there ain't none. So that's not quite what they were looking for. Then the other side, which is maybe you'd be less likely to think of, is the demand for milk will also rise. Maybe you're not that big on milk, so you're certainly not going to pay $3.50 a gallon, but if it were 10 cents, maybe you might. Or, you know, maybe you would say, hey, it's a luxury for Fido here. You know, I'll get some milk for Rover. I mean, that would be something, or for my cat. That you wouldn't have done before. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe you have some kind of weird attraction to milk, you want to bathe in it or something. And at $3.50 a gallon, there's no way you could afford it, but at 10 cents, you can just stand in the shower and just douse yourself. I'm like, whatever. But at 10 cents, you would do those things that you wouldn't do at $3.50. So here's two things happen at once. The supply of milk shrinks, and the demand for milk increases dramatically. So now you have more people trying to grab hold of less milk. So the result is not that everybody gets cheap milk. It's that a tiny sliver of the public gets cheap milk, and everybody else gets no milk at all. So every time you think, well, I can improve on the price that was reached by buyers and sellers on the market, you really can't, it turns out. You actually can't. And this is an area where every economist agrees on this. This is not just some weird conclusion that the liberals have reached. You read it, pick up any economics textbook written by anybody, and they will all tell you that price ceilings, or price controls, as they're more often called, lead to shortages and problems. Everybody will say that. Which is, I mean, basically, even most governments don't. I mean, Venezuela is doing that, but you know, what does that tell you? In the US, they don't generally do this anymore because they all know it doesn't work. I mean, even people who repeatedly do things that don't work don't do this. Okay, so they've really gotten this message. All right, I'll pause for a minute and then we'll go into this. This is the most funnest part of all. is this. All right, so let's see. We got like almost half an hour, right? All right, so let's do some more questions. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, earlier when you were talking about the deciding whether or not to like actually buy something, and that's how you tell somebody to not produce it, and that's a non-aggressive way, couldn't the argument be made that by declining to buy the product, you're starving the person, and by doing so, you're acting aggressively towards them?
Well, no, because if I were starving him by taking his food, then I would be acting aggressively against him. But if somebody comes up to me and says, my product is framed this, and if you don't buy this from me, you are aggressing against me. Now, my abstention from buying is not aggression. Because he doesn't have a right to my money, according to a liberal. He has a right not to have his money taken. But if I don't want this, and I'm not helping him in the long run by encouraging him to continue doing this. I think he needs to go into some other field. So it is better for him to learn sooner rather than, I mean, before he starts investing in 3 new plants and 17 new assistants and more lives get disrupted, it would be better for him to find out immediately this is not where he belongs in the economy. And especially now, I mean, you've got a lot of opportunities. You guys have it harder than I did 20 years ago going out into the, well, 20 years ago, I was in grad school, but I mean, I was about to go out into the world shortly thereafter, and everybody got jobs in the 1990s. Everybody had more job offers than you knew what to do with in the 1990s. And today, it's trickier, but also you have opportunities to learn things. You can go to lynda.com, L-Y-N-D-A, and learn all kinds of computer skills very quickly. I was just talking on my show the other day about a place called Hack Reactor out on the West Coast. It's a 12-week coding course for computer programmers. 12 weeks, extremely intense. But you get out of that program, and their average starting salary is $105,000. So now, not everybody's qualified to do that. But at the same time, my point is that you have opportunities in your spare time to pick up skills that I certainly wouldn't have had in my day. All right, yes?
Okay, so if the first person to use something, if it makes it theirs, can the second person to use it, can it be theirs? So like if the first person gives it?
Yeah, I should have said that. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. I neglected to mention that. Okay, let's say I am the first person to use something ever in the history of the world, and I start using it and it's mine. That doesn't mean that I can't, certainly I can sell it. That's part of owning something, is the ability to sell it. I can give it away, I can bequeath it to my heirs. I can do these things and transfer ownership to somebody else. That somebody else then becomes just as solidly the owner as I ever was. I can't come back and lord it over him and say, well, don't forget, I'm the first one to use it, so anytime I want to take that back from you, I can't. No, once I've transferred ownership, that person is absolutely very as much the owner as I ever was. Okay, good. All right, okay, here we go. Here's some fun misconceptions. Now, by the way, let me give you some, I should just run through a few scandalizing examples, because in case you're ready to jump on the bandwagon and say, you know I'm just studying ideas in school, but maybe I might want to adopt some of these ideas. Maybe I want you to hold your horses a little bit and think it through before you jump on this particular bandwagon. Even though I'm driving this bandwagon, okay? I got a podcast that talks about this stuff every single day. I got an episode that just went up while I was talking to you because my producer just put it up. So I do want to be a proselytizer for these ideas, but I also want to make sure you know what you're talking about and what it all amounts to. Let's suppose I want to go. Let's say I want to go buy some cocaine, and I buy it from somebody, and the government comes along and arrests both of us involved. Is that acceptable from a libertarian standpoint or not? No, it is not, because I haven't committed aggression against anybody. My decision to use this substance it does not involve anybody else, doesn't involve hurting anybody else, doesn't involve taking their stuff, so I should be allowed to do it. Okay. Should I be able to shout fire in a crowded theater? This is kind of a trick question. Like, we believe in the freedom of speech, right? But should I be able to shout fire in a crowded theater? How would a libertarian answer that question? You have any idea? It's a hard one. Oh, wait, hold on. Can I ask Regina?
Yes, absolutely. All right,
go ahead.
Giggling as you ask the question.
All right. I'm thinking to myself, heaven help me, have I actually discussed this around the house? All right. What's your answer?
It would be a kind of aggression.
Okay, you think because if I were to say it, people could get crushed because there'd be a big commotion, everybody trying to get out, right? Were you going to say something?
No, I was going to say.
Okay. The libertarian answer actually would be that a lot of these questions of rights come back ultimately to property. The real question would be, whose theater is it? And presumably, the theater owner probably has a policy about disrupting his show and leading to a commotion that kills people. So ultimately, in that issue, yeah, you wouldn't be able to shout fire in a crowded theater, but not because your right to free speech is restricted. Liberals think that you should only have your right to free speech in certain conditions, but it would be because it's not your property. So in that case, the property owner makes rules, and that is a case where you do know those rules when you enter that facility, and by entering that facility, physically, you have consented to those rules. So the issue would be who owns the property makes the rules. So in practice, it would be the same outcome. You can't shout fire. But it's not because free speech is not absolute. It's because property rights come first. Like nobody, we all believe in the freedom of speech, most of us, but that doesn't mean that I can come to your house during your dinner and tell you what a terrible person you are over and over and over. Right? I wouldn't. And then you could say, yeah, but that's in physical invasion and that's a different thing. All right, well, do I have the right to leave an MP3 player running in your house telling you what a terrible person you are all day and using terrible language and your parents are terrible and just leave this running? Of course not, because it's your property. That's the first question, is who owns the space sets the rules. All right. So, all right, so that was kind of a tricky question, the old fire in a crowded theater. The real question is, whose theater is it? And that'll solve it. You don't need to have a principal for this because the property owner will solve it. So, in other words, these are... and then the question of war is a complicated question for libertarians as well. I mean, for me it isn't, but for some libertarians it is. So there are a lot of things to think through here. It's not just the economy moves smoothly and we all earn a lot of money. There are a lot of other questions to delve into. All right, I'll do these quickly. Here's the objection I had when I was in the 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade. And that is that if you have an economy with little to no government involvement, over time you're going to have monopoly. You're going to have industries dominated by a few giant firms. And those firms will be able to charge whatever they want and everybody will be taken advantage of. I saw no reason not to believe this based on the textbooks that I was assigned in school. But I've actually now gone and looked at the data. How about that? I looked at the data. What was the American economy like in the 19th century? It turns out you can look it up. It turns out there are numbers for this. And this story that we all probably got in one form or another, that in the 19th century, the economy was dominated by terrible monopolists who exploited everybody, is not true. And I say that I don't even consider this debatable. It is not true. And here's how we know it's not true. First, some people are outraged that I'm claiming that it's not true, but it is not true. The key piece of evidence comes from an article written, as it turns out, by a friend of mine back when I was only 13 years old, so I was not reading it. It was my friend Tom DiLorenzo wrote an article in the International Review of Law and Economics in 1985. And what he actually did was he went back and looked at all the industries for which data was available in the late 19th century that were accused of being monopolized, like they were just a couple of big firms and they squeezed everybody and they could charge whatever they wanted because they're the only firms there. So he went back and looked and said, well, were prices going up or down in these industries? That would be a good question. Prices should be, if these industries like steel, sugar, whatever, if these are all being monopolized, well, the whole point of a monopoly is to get higher prices, right? That's why you want to be a monopolist. Prices should have been rising from 1875 to 1900, let's say. But prices were actually falling in the allegedly monopolized industries, and they were falling much faster than prices were falling elsewhere in the economy. Prices were falling across the board in the U.S. at that time, but much faster in the supposedly monopolized industries, and output was going up much faster in the supposedly monopolized industries. When we look at individual people like John D. Rockefeller or Andrew Carnegie or Cornelius Vanderbilt or any of these others, when you put aside the boogeyman stories about how terrible they were, the actual story is that Andrew Carnegie almost single-handedly made the price of steel rails go down by 90%. Well, that's a huge contribution to mankind, because everything in a modern economy uses steel, and if you can reduce the cost by 90%, that's incredible. And a libertarian would say, there's no government action that could do that. I mean, the government can take from you and give to somebody else. Well, okay, yeah, a thief with an IQ of 50 could do that. But something that makes everything in the economy cheaper now, because a major input is cheaper, is something that only an individual entrepreneur can do. Or John D. Rockefeller makes the price of kerosene go down 80%. And then gasoline, of course, refined petroleum as well. James J. Hill runs his own railroad at a time when every railroad operator was getting special privileges from the government. They were getting land grants from the government. They were getting special low-interest loans. Hill got none of that. And they all thought, oh, no way he's going to succeed. He built a railroad from St. Paul to Seattle. The Great Northern. And he was tremendously successful, made more profits than other railroad people. 1893, most of the other railroads went bankrupt. He's still posting a profit. Got no government assistance whatsoever and was extremely successful and kept his fares low. Cornelius Vanderbilt takes the price of transportation from New York to Philadelphia or New York to New Jersey and all these other places and cuts them by about two-thirds, or sometimes we'll ship you different places for free. He'll just sell food on board. So from that point of view, it's not obvious to me why we're supposed to be morally outraged by these people. Second major thing is the one I kind of joked about earlier. Well, isn't it true that in the 19th century, everybody was earning like 10 cents, and children had to work, and you know we're much better than that now, and we've reached a more mature state of historical development, and so we certainly wouldn't want to go backwards. I understand that. I bought that too, and it certainly is true that children worked, and it is true that people earned very low incomes. But the question has to be why. Why did they earn low incomes? Was it because the rich people were hoarding all the goods and not sharing them? Was it that? Well, let's think about what actually was going on. Like the Industrial Revolution, for example. Like, you know, people are working in factories and they work really long hours and it's just terrible. That's true, but what was going on before the Industrial Revolution? We never even ask this. We just assume that all of a sudden things were terrible. It's like one day everybody woke up and now it's off to the factories and things are terrible. Why did they go to the factories? If there were a million other great alternatives, why didn't they do those? Answer was, that was it. If you were not in agriculture and could not make a living in agriculture, or if you didn't have the tools to go into your own trade, there was nothing for you to do in the economy before the Industrial Revolution. There was no way to integrate you into the economy. You were just going to starve. There was nothing for you to do. The factory system at least allowed you to sell your labor services and stay alive, which was better than dying. So it's not that the choice was living a palatial existence or living in poverty. The choice was either living in poverty or living in unspeakable poverty. And during the Industrial Revolution, we now know that the standard of living did increase. The amount of food eaten, the amount of clothing owned, the amount of living space that people had was considerably greater during and after the Industrial Revolution. Now, why are they earning such low wages? Well, here's my thought experiment here. Well, that was supposed to... Now, you know what? We're going to think about this. We're going to keep this in our imagination. I was going to draw a spaceship, but no. Yeah, I know. That was not what you were thinking that was. Okay. All right. Let's imagine that invaders from Mars... This is my favorite way of explaining this. Invaders from Mars come to Earth, and they take everything that we use to make stuff. All the machines, all the assembly line equipment, everything we use to make things is taken away by the Martians. Now let's suppose we then get up the next morning and we go to work. We have no machines to work with. They even take all the communication equipment. They leave us a telegraph as a joke because they figure nobody knows how to use one. And that's it. We have no machinery whatsoever. Everything that you produce, you have to produce with basic hand tools or with your bare hands. Now let's compare the economy the day before the Martians came with the economy the day after the Martians came. The day before the Martians came, we could work 40 hours a week and at least get by. We could survive on 40 hours a week. And we could produce an incredible abundance of goods. I mean, we live in a time of such unbelievable abundance, no one could possibly imagine it, by the way. I mean, even the greatest kings of Europe did not have things that we take for granted today. Even the Habsburgs, the most famous family in European history, in their vacation home, they didn't even have flush toilets. Like, these are the highest name in European history. Okay, so we live in great abundance. Then the Martians come. Now we got to try and produce all this stuff with our bare hands. I think about my father. My father was a forklift operator, and he used to take really heavy pallets of food and move them from one place to another. If he had to do that with his bare hands, it would have taken him 500 times as long. There would be some stacks. There's no way a human being could possibly get something up that high. There'd be some things he couldn't possibly lift. No combination of people could have lifted. He couldn't have done that at all. But one piece of equipment revolutionizes his life, allows him to command a pretty good wage, and so on and so forth. But now imagine no machines. We're going to produce this much of what we used to produce. There'll be whole classes of goods we can't produce at all. How could you produce a plasma TV with your bare hands from start to finish? Can't be done. Try to do coal mining with your bare hands. Can't be done. So what would happen? We would all be poor because when we would get our paychecks, that money wouldn't go very far because there aren't enough goods out there. Every good would be very expensive because there are so few of them being produced because our economy stinks so badly. It can produce so few things that the money in our paychecks doesn't stretch very far. So we would be very, very unhappy. And we would have to work very long hours, right? Because we're trying to do the work that machines used to do. So maybe I have to work 120 hours a week. So now I work three times as long in an economy that's 500 times less efficient, just to stay alive. That's the reason we would be poor. The reason we would be poor in that economy would not be that somebody is hoarding all the plasma TVs. There aren't any. The reason we'd be poor is not that somebody is hoarding all the steak dinners. You'd be lucky to have gruel in that economy. Well, that's not just a crazy fantasy world that I just described. That's what they were enduring at this time. They're living at a time when, on the eve of the Industrial Revolution, things are barely mechanized at all. So the economy produces a pitiful amount of output, which means every single item you buy is going to be very expensive because there aren't that many of them and everybody's trying to compete to buy them. But if you can produce, if business firms are free to take their profits, spend them on machines, you can produce way more and each good will be much cheaper. And now you can buy all that stuff with your paycheck. So that's why you had low wages. The economy was poor. It couldn't produce enough stuff. If you had gone to all the rich people and said, hey, you're one of the rich people, so you're the richest person out of 1,000. So I'm going to take your income and I'm going to divide it by 999 and redistribute it to 999 people, there wouldn't be enough to make a difference to anybody. If you thought, well, that rich guy, he's got 20 times as much furniture as the poor guy, so I will take his furniture and divide it up, and everybody would wind up with this much of a table leg, and that'd be the end of it. There'd be no appreciable difference. What got people out of the low wages was the ability to invest in machines so that you could produce more, and the greater abundance pushed prices down, people could afford them. That was the process. As for children working, children have worked since the beginning of time because economies have been lousy and unproductive. And the reason they work, and even the International Labor Organization, which is not a free market group, has admitted the reason children work is that their families will starve if they don't. This is not a question of all the bad parents in the world coincidentally happen to live in Bangladesh. Like all the parents making their kids work, by an odd coincidence, happen to live in the same country. It's a desperately poor country, and yeah, they don't want their kids to have to work, but they also don't want their kids to die. And so that's the reason. But meanwhile, in the West, we have campaigns against child labor. Nobody likes child labor. But what a liberal would say is the best antidote to child labor is a free economy, where you've got a lot of machines. The economy is productive enough that the kids don't have to work. The parents alone, with the help of machines, can produce enough stuff they don't need the kids' labor. But what's happened in case after case is countries like this have been pressured into abolishing child labor, because that seems like the humanitarian thing to do. But does that mean that by abolishing child labor, do you now take the threat of starvation away? It's still there. So now the children either become prostitutes, or they work in extremely dangerous fields, or they die, which is exactly what has repeatedly happened. I'll skip atomistic individualism. Nobody really worries about that anymore. I think that's just a caricature. Who cares about that? Only I do. Finally, inequality, just because this comes up a lot. Don't you wind up with a lot of inequality in an economy like this, that some people have a whole lot, some people have a little? There are a lot of ways to answer this, but I'm going to answer it in two simple ways. The first way is Mises, whom I talked about here, had this great example. He said, hundreds of years ago, if you compared the mode of transportation used by different people, poor and rich, the poor traveled on foot, and they would be lucky if they owned a pair of shoes. The rich traveled in a coach and four, which is a coach driven by four horses. Today, the rich man has a super sleek car, but the poor man has a beat-up car. But they're both cars. This is obviously a dramatic reduction in inequality in the only sense that really matters, that we can both get around at 55 miles an hour. This was not possible before. Secondly, up until the early 19th century, up through about the 1820s into the 1850s, people in the world, on average, lived on this much per day. That was the average income around the world. And it had been that way for centuries, $3 a day. Now that means your food, your shelter, your clothing, your entertainment, of course you'll have plenty of that on $3 a day, all has to be purchased with that. That was what everybody, and no one, notice nobody was protesting poverty in the year 1600. Nobody protested poverty because they thought it's hopeless to bother. That's just a fact of life. We're going to be born into squalor and misery. We're going to live a short, miserable life, and we're going to drop dead, and there's nothing we can do about it. Nobody protested against that. They protest it now because they live in a society where poverty does decline, and they think this is just automatic. It's not automatic. Okay, but now, do you know what the number is now? The figure has gone up by a factor of 11. $33 a day. Even if we average in the poorest countries in the world, the average now is $33 a day. An 11-time increase has never been seen in the history. Never. We've never had anything like that. Certainly not in a span of time like this. Now, $33 a day, not ideal. Absolutely. But if you were creative enough, you're telling me you couldn't figure out a way to at least survive on $33 a day? Whereas I bet most of us could not survive on $3. But you can at least live on 33. And as I say, this even factors in some of the worst places, worst governed places in the world. And it's 33. Did that just happen by accident? Or is it just a coincidence that this happens at the very time that the economies of the world are starting to go in this direction? Well, a liberal would say this is what you should expect, is it precisely that poverty will decline. And the poverty figures are much lower now than they were two centuries ago, because we've unleashed this ability to create wealth. So that would be the answer. Who cares about inequality if the poorest people in the world now are seeing this, that everybody is at least this level, basically, on average? That's what really matters, is that now people, more people than ever, can live a civilized life and not be on the edge of starvation for most of their lives. That's a huge step forward. And it would be wrong to neglect that. All right, I think I've taken you right up to the end, and you have been exceptionally patient and generous with me. So thank you very much. What are you have some
we
closing?
Have 10 minutes here.
Oh, it's 10:40. 11:40. 11:40. Oh, good. Okay, so I'm glad I rushed myself. Good, okay. So we'll see if... now you get into trouble. If they don't have questions, do you ever let them go early? Because are they going to get in trouble if they ask? Like, people are going to say, why did you ask a question? I want to go to lunch.
No.
I don't want to get anybody in trouble. Okay.
No.
All right. Go ahead and ask then. Ask away.
With the monopoly, you were talking about the specific men and specific price decreases that they had. Since they did run monopolies, why do you think they didn't raise prices?
Well, for one thing, even the most dominant of them always had at least some competition. And although John D. Rockefeller had 80 to 90% of the refinery business in the U.S. by the late 19th century, by the time the government got him into court to break him up, he was already down to 25% because other competitors came in and whittled down his share. So they're going to come to the rescue 10 years after he's already lost the dominant position. So that happened. Then also, there is always implicit competition. That people know, they know that if I raise my price up to here, 10 firms are going to come in and compete with me, and I would rather not bother with that. In fact, the primary producer of aluminum throughout the 20th century was Alcoa. And basically, they had virtually no competition at all. And yet, aluminum prices consistently came down because they knew, first of all, that if they raise prices, they'll have competition, you know, next Tuesday. They know that. But secondly, there are substitutes for aluminum. You don't absolutely have to have aluminum. So aluminum, even though you are a monopoly, that's not quite right because you are competing against substitutes that people could use. And then also, really, every good in the economy is competing with every other good. Because if movie tickets go up too high, then I can rent a movie, I can go for a walk, I can go get a burger. The movies have to compete not just with other movie theaters, but with every other avenue for my entertainment dollar. So that's some of the reasons. Yes.
My question is also on the monopoly.
Okay.
My question is, how much of that decrease in price was due to these monopolies trying to sell lower? Get rid of the competition.
Right. Okay, so the question is, could this have been part of a strategy to drive out competitors? You sell so low that that your competitors can't afford to sell at that low, and then you get your competitors out, and then once they're out, then you raise your prices. This is a strategy called predatory pricing, where you deliberately sell at a loss. You take losses for a certain period of time with the hope of doing precisely this. Now, this theory did hold sway for a little while, but it is not held in very high regard in the economics profession any longer. There was a Nobel Prize winner named George Stigler who said that it would be embarrassing to encounter this doctrine in professional economics these days. And it's not obvious why, because it does seem plausible, right? I take losses for just a little while, I drive my competitors out, and then I raise the prices. Now today we can think of examples of firms that have low prices and competitors get driven out. But then raising those prices up again? It's hard to think of examples. Dominic Armentano, who's retired from the University of Hartford, wrote a couple of very important books on antitrust, and he went through and looked at the major antitrust cases where this was alleged, where the firm was accused of this type of strategy. And he said, I was not able to find one case where a firm had been successful in it. And for some of the reasons that I just mentioned, also other reasons would be when you sell really low, consumers go out and stock up on the item. And so then when you figure, okay, I'll raise my prices, well, they've now got a huge supply, and so it takes you even longer to do it. Secondly, when your competitors do go out of business, like what happens when a firm goes bankrupt? You go into bankruptcy court and they sell off your assets. They sell off your storefront and all, you know, your trucks or whatever. And the people who buy them are buying them for like 15% of what you paid for them. So now you have, you know, here's Joe's store, goes out of business, all his stuff is sold off in bankruptcy. But now Bill, who's going to open Bill's store, now has 15% of the costs of Joe because he got all of Joe's stuff in bankruptcy court for nothing. So now he's going to be an even tougher competitor to deal with. Now you got to drive that competitor out. It becomes an exhausting process. So it turns out that it's not one that firms have been successful with or have wanted to adopt. Now in this case, it never actually happened. Whether they were trying it, it never actually came about because the prices just kept on going. And then, as I say, competition in the traditional sense of a whole bunch of firms got more and more intense, and so prices never did actually rise. But that's the basic. I have an article that goes into all the details of that. It's not a long article, but it's called "The Misplaced Fear of Monopoly." And if you Google "The Misplaced Fear of Monopoly," my article will come up, and it talks about all the reasons that it's difficult for predatory pricing to work. Yes.
I understand that $33 would be the average.
Right.
What would your response be to people who say, "But yes, but there are people who live on more than that, and so that's unfair that they have more than"?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and of course there are. I mean, everybody in this room probably lives on more than that. Okay. Well, I would say it would have to come down to your question of fairness, because that would be the question about what is fair, what isn't fair. Is it fair for somebody to earn extra money because he, let's say the government broke the kneecaps of all his competitors? Well, we would say that's not fair. So his money is an ill-gotten gain. But somebody else who just works nonstop and just works and works and works and earns extra money, is that really not fair? Well, that would come down to your ultimately to your question of fairness. I would say this. Let's think about inequality in the United States. People are up in arms about inequality in the United States. Now, to me, yeah, I don't own a yacht and I don't own a private jet, but the fact that other people do does not hurt me in any way. It doesn't make my speaking fees lower. It doesn't mean fewer people listen to my show. It's completely irrelevant to me. So it's not worth my worrying about and to be envious, which is a sinful disposition anyway. But think of the difference in income between the average American and the average person living in Nigeria or India. Now, India is getting richer all the time, but let's just say Nigeria or India. It is a huge difference. So people could just as easily say, is it fair for you as an American, through no merit of your own, you happen to be born into an extremely rich country. That's not any merit of yours. It's just luck. Why should you have the benefit of earning all this extra money? Shouldn't you give all your excess money to people in Nigeria? Now, when they talk about inequality in the U.S., they never raise this issue, inter-country inequality, because they realize that, yeah, even the middle class in America, where some of them are saying, give me more, They don't want to give more. They don't want to give more to people in India who earn much less than they do. They don't want to give more to people in Egypt. They want to keep it. So if once you go down that road, it seems to me you would have to commit yourself to, if I have anything that is in excess of what people in the poorest country in the world have, then I can't have it. I don't think that's the case. Now, it would be a very meritorious thing for you to divest yourself of these things, but you are also given the task of caring for your own household. So I would say that it is okay for you to earn the money. But as I say, the reason I gave that intra-country example is to show that I don't think really there's anybody in this room, I don't know you that well, but I don't think there's anybody who would say, well, you're right, I should probably go back to earning $15 a day and giving all the excess to people elsewhere in the world. If you'd like to do that, then I want to write an article about your heroism. So point yourself out to me. But I don't think you do. Let me give on the predatory pricing thing, let me close with a story. You'll like this story. I forgot to tell it to you. This is a great example of why it's so hard for that to work. I just thought of it while I was talking. It's the old story of Herbert Dow, the chemical manufacturer, the American chemical manufacturer. This was about 100 years ago. I thought of him because I was talking about working extremely hard. This guy worked 16-hour, 18-hour days. Sometimes he slept at his plant. And he wanted to break into the bromine market in Europe. And at that time, it was a German cartel that dominated the bromine market. Oh, you know this story? Yeah. Yeah. And the German cartel's view was that no one can sell bromine in Europe. Only we may sell it. And now you got this upstart American, Herbert Dow, who's trying to sell bromine. And they're selling it at 49 cents a pound. Well, he starts selling it at 36. And they're just outraged. They're outraged. I mean, they actually send a representative to his office and they say, you have to stop selling in Europe. We sell in Europe, nobody else. And he says, well, I'm going to keep doing it. So they say, we'll use predatory pricing against him. We will sell at a loss just to crush him. So they start selling, the Germans start selling bromine in the U.S. for 15 cents a pound, taking a huge loss. But they figure it'll all be worth it someday when we get rid of Herbert Dow. So Dow takes a look and says, wow, they want to sell it to me for 15 cents a pound? Because I guess I'll buy it then. So he secretly buys, he has his purchasing agent buy up huge quantities at 15 cents. And then he sells those in Europe at 27 cents a pound. And they have no idea what's going on. Like, they didn't expect him to buy at that price. So he bought it at 15 cents. He's selling it at 27 cents. So now they're starting to lose profits in Europe, which they need profits in Europe to be able to hurt him in the U.S. So they think, all right, we'll sell it at 10.5 cents a pound in the U.S., like thick. They're not seeing the strategy here. So he buys it at that price and undersells them in Europe. So they finally say to him, would you please stop doing that? And they surrender. And he wins. So that's a kind of a good flesh and blood story of why, with a really skilled entrepreneur, you don't try a strategy like that. All right, I guess we're out of time now.
Well, with maybe a couple minutes here, if we go over just a second.
Okay, yeah.
What would you say is the positive role of government? Is there any legitimate role of government in society for the libertarian? Because a lot of this is this is aggression.
Right. Yeah. Well, I would say that the majority of libertarians would hold to something like a Lockean view. The majority of libertarians would say that you need government for police and military and to uphold the rule of law in a system of courts. This would be called the night watchman state, where a night watchman doesn't tell you what to eat or, whatever, how much money you can keep, but he does protect you. There is a minority among libertarians that comes to the conclusion that in the same way that monopolies are bad in everything else, monopolies are bad in the provision of all these other services. So, and also, government is inherently based on aggression, so there is no legitimate function for it. And then you have a middle ground. Ayn Rand was the moderate middle, if you can believe this. Ayn Rand's view was that, yes, taxation cannot be morally allowed, but we can't have competing defense agencies and competing court systems. So what we'll have is a government, but it'll be voluntarily funded. And if people really think it's worth something, then they'll put their money where their mouth is and they will voluntarily pay for government. So those are the three positions that I'm aware of, and I will leave ambiguous what my own position is because I have been foisting that on you all morning. All right, good.
We're out of time. Thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right, everybody, that's the show for today. Remember, your free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, you can get that by texting the word LIBERTY to 33444. Then you'll get my weekly letter, and if you hate it, you can just stop getting it or throw it away or whatever. But you get this nice big ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. Text the word LIBERTY to 33444. If you like the show and it's benefiting you and you're learning something from it and you enjoy it every day, then please consider supporting it as a supporting listener, because you get a ton of stuff. A ton of stuff. Look at, you're going to be like a kid in a candy store looking at the stuff I give you guys. That's over at supportinglisteners.com. Do please give that serious consideration. See you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.